Well, I've got 2 minutes after, so why don't we begin? And we appreciate all of you being here. My name is Rex Brown. I'm with Advantage Performance Group, and we're very happy to have Scott Roberts with us today. And we're also very pleased to have all of you who are on the line. We apologize again for the change in the phone number that happened without our being involved in it, but we appreciate you finding the number and being able to join us today. A couple of housekeeping things. We'll, in about a minute here, I'm going to mute the lines, and then when we get to the end of the presentation, we'll unmute them so that you can ask questions of Scott. So I'd like to introduce Scott to begin with. Scott has a great background for our presentation today. Scott is with Accordance. Accordance is one of our alliance partners. They provide the negotiation skills programs that we provide to our clients. And Scott has been with Accordance for a number of years. He has a great background in sales as a salesperson and as a sales manager and in senior sales management. But Scott also has a unique combination of not only the sales experience, but also has been a merger and acquisitions lawyer and has been doing negotiations for a number of companies. And so he trained at the Harvard Negotiation Project and just has a tremendous background to help us today in our discussion about negotiation. And boy, there isn't anything that's more timely than negotiation skills now. So, Scott, to that topic, that it's timely, you know, our clients are really, they're getting beaten up by their salespeople, they're getting beaten up by customers, as the first thing they go to is to try to lower price in this economy. So, so thanks for presenting what you're doing today. I think it's going to be very valid and helpful for what's happening in the economy, and we're going to go on the assumption that there's something that we can do about that when they try to beat us up on price. Do you want to take it from there?
Sure, I will, Rex. Good afternoon or good morning, everybody, whichever coast you are on. I hear this all too often in my negotiation work, whether it was even before we got into the recession, I'll call it, that we're in now, but especially now you hear it more and more. And people are always asking, what can we do and what can we do differently? I think the first thing I always start off and say is you have to maintain the right attitude towards it, and we'll talk about that in a little while. But on top of that, there are other things we can do from a planning and execution stand that actually work very well along the way. I remember years ago when I was running a sales and marketing organization, one of our customers, our large accounts, was Walgreens. And Walgreens Drugs, of which we were, it was like our fourth largest account at that point, was deciding that they were going to go down the path of trying to figure out how to grow the business, because they were in a time where it wasn't growing like they liked to in same-store sales. They were growing by adding stores, but not by growing the pie. So they came back to a number of us that were in a high-margin business, which we were for the product that we sold them, and came to us and said, what we want to do next year is not grow by 3%. We want to grow by 15%. We'd like you to come in and be a strategic partner. Now, whenever I hear that, I tend to hold my wallet because I never know what that actually means. But I took it face value and said, we will definitely participate. And they wanted us to come in and spend half a day with senior merchandising people to talk about how we grow the business. So we put our plans together. We went in to, the salespeople went in. I actually attended the meeting. And we spent a half a day working through strategies of what we could do. And everybody liked what we had put together. We were also part of a contingency of three companies they were looking at. So there were two other competitors that had yet to present. And they said, well, we'll get back to you in a couple of weeks. So a couple of weeks go by, we get a call, and lo and behold, we said, you've been selected as our strategic partner. Of course, we're excited because 15% growth was not something you were getting in those days, and we were looking forward to being able to implement the plan. So we said, well, what we need is a GO, and that was Walgreens' nomenclature for a purchase order. They called it a general order. And what ended up, so we asked for that, and they said, well, you don't get it from us. You really need to speak to the buyer about that. And so we said, okay. So we, our people called up the buyer and said, gee, we just won this strategic partnership, which they knew about, and so now we need to get a GO to get started. And the buyer said, wait a minute, not so fast. You won the strategic partnership, but we have to decide at what price. Well, you can imagine what took place then. We ended up negotiating. Well, of course, we took things off the table as they kept pushing on price and other things involved. And we ended up at the end of the year growing the pie at Walgreens by a little over 4% that year. I learned a valuable lesson, and it's the one that I take away in most of the negotiation that I do, and this happened even before I went to the Harvard Negotiation Project or law school, that I had sold on value but negotiated on price. And I want to invest the next hour into exploring approaches to negotiate, really negotiate, not haggle, which is what I felt happened in that particular scenario. I routinely watched really good salespeople and negotiators do a great job, especially on the sales side, of selling on value only then to negotiate predominantly on price.
You know, Scott, one of the reasons I've been looking forward to this webcast is because I'm not a good negotiator, and I really don't like to haggle. So what can we do about that? I mean, for those of us that aren't so great at that, where do we start, and how do we approach a negotiation?
Well, you ask a good question, and it really does depend first and foremost on the view you take and then the approach you take in your negotiation. Many times, as I said earlier, I see sales forces sell on value. Great job. Close the customer on the value, and then start to negotiate price and terms as a separate activity. Many times we view the sale and negotiation of terms and conditions as separate. And in some cases, negotiation is seen as transactional and even turned over to the lawyers or finance or corporate contracts to conclude. So as corporate contracts comes in many times, sales in many instances has even set corporate contracts up to fail, because we've given certain things away, in effect, taken a lot of our negotiables off the table. And so therefore, corporate contracts is already trying to bail the boat rather than try to sail it in the negotiation. There's an assumption made by sales and sales management, many times senior management, that everyone knows the value once we go to the contract to negotiate, and nothing could be further from the truth. Wrong assumption, wrong approach, and we disconnected our value from the price that we deserve. And as I always say, so is in the absence of knowing value, people always go to price. It's one of the golden rules that in the absence of value, people will always go to price, similar to the position of victim I put myself into at Walgreens.
So Scott, how do we not become a Walgreens victim?
So you think I was a victim too, huh?
Yeah, I think you said that, yeah.
Yeah, no, fair point. Yeah, you're right, I did. And I do think this is how many sales professionals sometimes see themselves, right? Caught in the middle of the need to make my numbers and the power that we perceive buyers have over us. I think the first thing we need to do is change our attitude about negotiating. Top salespeople understand and discipline themselves to bring their value into the negotiation process and connect it to what is valuable to the customers. In effect, they understand that selling and negotiating happen simultaneously. It reminds me in the medical device industry, I was working with a salesperson, and we were working with a rather large hospital on a sizable sale of a little over $1 million worth of capital equipment. And we went in, and before we went in, I asked him what we were going to do that day, and he said, we're going to go to purchasing and get a purchase order. So I thought that was interesting to start off with, that we had concluded there was a sale. And we went in, and we met with the purchasing person. That's the only person in the room was the purchasing manager. I knew we were in trouble at that point, because purchasing managers only focus basically on price. So they started to negotiate us, the purchasing manager did, even against the quote that we had already sent in. So we were all, again, back to bailing out the boat. We found a way to extricate ourselves there without making any commitments, and I went and talked to this person about who they had sold the value to, and we found out that it was to the two doctors and the director of OR. I said, so we have to get those people in the room with this purchasing manager. So we spent a number of weeks getting that organized, and lo and behold, we actually got one of the doctors and the director of OR in the meeting with the purchasing manager, and it was amazing how the entire room changed, because we did two things. One thing is we brought the value into that room. The second thing is we entered some leverage into it, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. And that leverage was the relationships that the doctor and the director of OR had with that purchasing manager. And the director of OR and the doctor wanted this. And the purchasing manager then had to acquiesce in certain places in our negotiation. And while we still had to negotiate price a little more, it got nowhere near what the purchasing manager had started in the beginning. So what you do in the selling phase of the process has a clear, direct impact on the final outcome of negotiations because they are, in fact, integrated.
Scott, that concept is a little different for some of us. Can you say some more about that?
Sure, I can. I first think that as we think about negotiation, I try to go through some indicators that tell us where we are in the negotiation process. How well are we doing? And I'm going to share 9 of them with you to think about and ask yourself, how well am I doing here? Because if you're not doing really well on all of these, it probably is because you're not bringing the value into the negotiation process, and you might be viewing these things as two separate acts along the way. The indicators that I look at, and the most important ones, is the first one is the sales team that's responsible for driving 70% of your gross profit, do they know their customer strategies, and are they seen as an important part of its execution? Secondly, are customers rarely trying to renegotiate their contract with you before its expiration, and do they rarely fail to live up to its terms? Thirdly, is there pricing and terms integrity in your marketplace? A very good indicator of how well you're doing in that in the area of negotiation. Fourth, do negotiation strategies exist for the 70% of your business revenue, and is it integrated into your sales and marketing programs? In other words, does everybody know how we're approaching each of these large customers that drive most of our business? do the salespeople have clear guidelines and authority to culminate agreements themselves without management assistance, including walking away if they need to? Next, is sales management an effective coach and not the dominant negotiator in most of the negotiations that you do? Does the sales team regularly culminate their negotiations for more than 30% above their bottom line? Do salespeople consistently demonstrate to customers why the value of the negotiation is objective and fair? And do they always have rationale for their concessions? And do your salespeople rarely overreact to negotiation tactics? I think that many times what ends up happening is if we can say we're not doing really well for that, I think we find out that we may or may not have the most effective approach to negotiation. Because effective negotiators start up by finding why buyers want to buy. In essence, they're trying to find out what problem are we trying to solve. Too often, negotiators, I find, are solution finders rather than first taking the first step of defining the problems. For instance, I happen to be working with a particular company that sold a digital equipment approach to a particular marketplace. And we went in to sell this particular clinic, and we're talking with a number of doctors in there about this approach to what we were doing. And what I found out quickly was they weren't interested as much in the technology. And so as we kept going along with the conversation of presenting our features and benefits of all the great things we did, I said to them, well, how much of the business is tied up in this particular area that we're talking about, this particular equipment area we're talking about? And they said, well, it's about 60-65% of our revenue. I said, so why did you agree to meet with us? What are you looking for from us that you can't get from anybody else right now? And one of the people said was, well, we're looking to figure out a way to make more money. So it wasn't about lower price at that point, and that's a significant thing. They said, we want to make more money. Well, the interesting thing for our product was because it was digital, the reimbursement on it that you get, it was a medical device, the reimbursement you get from the insurance companies is almost twice what you'd get for the current technology ahead in, which was analog. So we no longer needed to focus on selling them on the technology. We needed to show them how they could make more money with our product. In effect, we negotiated very little on the price because they saw the value that we were bringing at the table because of the digital approach that we were doing it. So while the technology was valuable, don't get me wrong, more profit in this instance was the superior value that we're looking to find. Effective negotiators use this, not better products, better services, better prices. Customers are looking for value differentiators among their partners and suppliers, yet many sales negotiators focus on providing product benefits different from our competitors. Problem with that is what I find is we just commoditize ourselves because the buyer hears from one person one set of features and benefits, from us another, and after a while they all blend together, and the features and benefits may or may not solve the problem they're looking for. Therefore, we're seen as commoditized, and off we go down the price ball game versus trying to find out what they want to solve as a problem, what's interesting to them, and then bringing the value to it. In fact, research shows...
Scott, what have you done then that really helps us to find those value differentiators? What, that's going to be key to the negotiation. How have you found them?
Sure. Let me present a piece of research, and then I'll kind of jump into that. The research shows that 90% of buyers say they would buy on the basis of superior value and performance 90% of the time, not solely on price. So that's a big number. It tells me that they really would focus on value unless many times we take them there. So if our supplier performance is undifferentiated, we can drive our buyers directly to price. So performance is much more than that better product, better service, better prices. So now, John, back to your question. So how do we get to these value differentiators? We use a simple yet straightforward approach. If we can get the customer to give us what it is that they're truly interested in and what's valuable, we can work on that, similar to what I discussed in that analog versus digital example that I gave you. If we can get the value that they're looking for, we then can sell and negotiate with that customer together. But getting the performance value, turning it into options, and negotiating value for value can be hard, but it's simple. We use the simple, straightforward framework that allows us to design an approach, develop strategy and conversation, and forecast potential offers and decision points. The framework you see in front of you was developed by Grant Lum while he was at the Harvard Negotiation Project. The original concepts of this were based on research done at the Harvard Negotiation Project by Roger Fisher and subsequently written about in his book, Getting to Yes. Grant worked with Roger to refine this work, simplified into a framework that is easily learned and can be quickly applied in the fast-paced world of business. And I had the privilege of attending the Harvard Negotiation Project while I was in law school and have used this approach ever since then for about 20-some years.
You know, Scott, it's really good to know that these principles are based on solid research. But now, if you apply this in a sales organization, how do you go about doing that?
Sure. So I first want to start by looking at the dig and develop area of the slide that's in front of you, and you'll see interest, options, criteria, and no agreement alternatives. This is the main guts of what we need to focus on if we're actually going to understand the value and then turn value into things that we can negotiate, and I want to go through each of those briefly. But before we even get there, I always start at a higher level. And the first thing I always start with is the people that are negotiating. As I said to you earlier, I believe negotiation is a balance of aptitude and attitude. And the research would show you that that over 5,000 or 6,000 lawyers that were surveyed, lawyers and negotiators that were surveyed, they were asked which was more important, aptitude or attitude. And over 70% of them said that attitude was more important than aptitude. So the research would tell you that and lead you in the direction of having the right attitude is critically important. Without a team that believes in themselves and the negotiating value as a company, they can never uncover those customer value needs and convince them that our value, which is more important, will provide that superior performance. Secondly, your negotiation team must focus on the right habits. And there are this approach is a balance of effectiveness over efficiency. So I always ask, are you an efficient negotiator or are you an effective negotiator?
So Scott, what are those habits? What are the habits that you see that are effective then?
Yeah, there are four of them, and I would like to juxtapose those against the efficiency side so we get a chance to see the difference between and of what the research would say is the effective habits of a negotiator versus those of being efficient. And I do want to start off by saying there is a blend. There's a balance of effectiveness and efficiency, especially as quarter ends, and we get the pressure to make our numbers. Clearly, we tend to get a little more efficient, but the more we can be effective, the better we'll be in the longer term in a negotiation from that perspective. The very first one is a willingness to prepare. I go into all my sessions, and I start saying the word preparation, 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 preparation. If you are not prepared, you are prepared to fail, I think someone said at one point. And what we find is effective negotiators prepare two times more than the efficient one. So they spend twice the amount of time preparing to go into a negotiation. Efficient negotiators, because they're not prepared, and this is still today roughly 70-80% of negotiators go in unprepared in negotiations, which just surprises me. They're seen as positional. If they don't know what's important, we tend to talk about everything. We tend to throw anything we can against the wall and see what sticks and then try to make it work from there. The second one is having high expectations. Effective negotiators go in and not only know their bottom line, but they also set a very high expectation of what they expect to get out of this negotiation. Efficient negotiators tend to be bottom line focused. There was research done on this where they took 200 negotiators at the Wharton School, and they took all 200 and said, here's the bottom line. You can't go below this number. Then they took half of those, 100 of them, and they said, "But what we want you to do is set a high expectation. What's a very high goal, stretch goal of what you want to get out of this negotiation?" And everybody announced what they were going to get. They wrote it down as to what they were shooting for. And then they went off and negotiated, and when they came back, what they found was the bottom line focus negotiator tend to negotiate about 6 to 8% above their bottom line. That was what they came back in with. The high expectations and bottom line focus negotiators tend to be 25 to 30% above their bottom line just by simply setting a high expectation. Because if you think about it, if the bottom line is the only thing you have that becomes your goal, it becomes a thing to avoid, and what ends up happening is we negotiate towards it versus having a high expectation where it's harder to walk away from it. So high expectations, number two. Number three is a patience to listen. Effective negotiators listen four times as much as their efficient counterparts. Efficient counterparts are seen as focused on convincing versus listening. As I always say, you know, no new good idea enters one's mind through an open mouth. And in this case, I find more times that by asking questions, I get more information and more ideas, and many times the best ideas come directly from the other side that I'm negotiating with. But if my mouth is always open and I'm not listening to what they're having to say, I don't get the benefit of the thinking that they have. And many times, negotiators, that if you're willing to listen, you can ask questions and the other side will eventually get to most of the place where you want to be at the end of the negotiation. The last one is personal integrity. Without trust, you know, all else fails, I say. And if you think about it, there's a lot of work out there that says as trust goes up, speed goes up and costs go down. So this is where an effective negotiator actually becomes more efficient, because if they, in fact, have good integrity and high trust with their clients and negotiating and the buyers they work with, they will naturally go faster because they have established that trust. Efficient negotiators are seen as manipulative. And now, I'm not saying they are manipulative, but if you think about their habits, they tend to be positional, they tend to be bottom-line focused, and they tend to be focused on convincing. They tend to be, from the buyer's perspective, seen as manipulative. And that, in effect, becomes a negative effect on that particular negotiator, because that's what the buyer perceives the other side wants to do, is negotiate that. So without trust, you cannot be effective.
So, Scott, if I were a sales manager and I were thinking, what would I see somebody do to represent being an effective negotiator? Take it down a level, if you would, and tell us what you'd actually see somebody do to be effective.
Sure. Great question. The first thing is mapping your world, and this is a critical step that I think most of us miss. When I go into any negotiation scenario, and usually I'm brought in when it's pretty far down the path, and the first question I ask is, what's the situation? What I get back many times is, what's the situation from the viewpoint of the company I'm working with? And I will always say, no. I want, what's the situation from their point of view? What do they think the situation is right now? And try to frame up what they're thinking from that perspective. So I always start with the other side and say, if this is the world we want to live in, we have to understand their world. The next thing then is to understand the entire external number of people that are involved and the internal groups that we negotiate with inside our company. And many times I find that most people will say, it's harder to negotiate internally than externally. And there's some real reason for it, because we never ask again, what's the situation even from our internal negotiator's perspective, be it finance, be it operations, be it marketing, being whoever we're working with internally on this particular deal. So I always ask, who are those interested parties? Effective negotiators go one step further. And they say, if I'm going to get my high expectation, this stretch goal, who are the parties I need to get interested in this negotiation? And many times those things aren't asked for. If you think back to my Walgreens example, what if I had just asked myself that question, right? Who are the parties I need to get interested? Well, I would have said, of course I need to get the buyers involved here. And because that way they're in the room with what we're doing. Now, whether Walgreens was doing that to try to break up the negotiation that way, which didn't have an effect, or not, I don't know. But it would have been more effective if I could have tried to have them involved, or at least have kept them informed. So effective negotiators know how to negotiate externally and internally and get the right parties at the table. Because I don't know how often on an internal negotiation I've seen good salespeople become marginalized because they lost credibility internally through their negotiating efforts when they didn't know how to do it. So once you really have your situation all players, you can get to the heart of the matter. And the first thing is understanding interests. Interests are the needs, motivators, and concerns of parties. Interests clearly underlie positions. And one of the golden rules of negotiation that I always say is that all value is personal, and then we justify corporately. If you don't understand what's personally valuable to people, you will never get to what's really valuable from a corporate standpoint. Because everything goes through the lens of the person you're talking to, and they ask, the first question is this good for me? And if it's not, you're going to have a tough time negotiating. If it is, they're going to support you along the way. World-class negotiators or effective negotiators understand this and go beyond the obvious to understand both corporate and personal goals. This is the place where I always ask, what problem are you trying to solve? I happened to be negotiating just this past week and unfortunately was in the Chicago airport with all the background noise, but that's the way this group wanted to get this thing done and done now. And we were negotiating a rather sizable deal. And they were hitting me with all kinds of different things. They were talking about payment terms. They were talking about interest rates. They were talking about fee costs and so forth and so on. And I finally asked them, I said, wait a minute, what problem are we trying to solve here? And they said, well, while we're in learning development, we charge this to sales. We can't guarantee they'll pay within 30 days. And so we're concerned about payment terms. That was great information. Right there, I understood the interest that they had. And we formulated options around that particular interest. And when they came up with fees and wanted to negotiate those, I asked how that impacted the payment terms. So it allowed me to have some leverage, but it also gave me where to focus on that was important to them. If I hadn't asked that question, I wouldn't have understood their interests. And so many times I see salespeople do, whether it's whatever you have as a sales process out there and filling out forms, and I look at those forms and they say, what are the customer's goals and objectives? And many times their position's not interests. So it's like treating symptoms and not root causes. And I try to focus on root causes versus that. If someone's asking me for I want your lowest price, I always say, why? Why do you want my lowest price? My lowest price, that sounds like you want cheap. And obviously you're not a company that wants cheap. And you'd be surprised how often would people say, well, I want to save costs. You want to save costs. You don't want my lowest price. And it allows us to start dealing with how do we help them save money, make money, or whatever it may be, but not focus predominantly on price in what you do. So good negotiators understand that the goal is to achieve more value or profit and not a victory just on price. So when you understand that the interest of all parties, you create really good leverage points in your favor.
So, Scott, you know, if I then understand their interests, what's next? What does that help me do?
Sure. Obviously, at that point, well, it's obvious to me, but not to you. We want to now say, okay, if these are the interests, how do I solve those interests? And that's what we call options. Options are the solutions that satisfy interests, the possibilities that both parties can agree to. World-class negotiators and effective negotiators take those interests and create options that satisfy both sides' interests. In fact, what I like to do is generate multiple interests. I don't like one option, to go back, one quote. I don't like that. Even in RFPs, I will see if we can do multiple options within the RFP if that's allowed. And the reason I do that is if it's one option, you have only the choice of two answers, yes, no. That's high risk in my mind. If I have multiple options, now I create a conversation around multiple options. And many times you'll find a buyer say, well, I like this and this one, and I don't like this and this, but if you put this one and that one, I like this. And what I get going is a conversation, not a yes or no answer, where I'm stuck in a position of having to defend. And so I'm always trying to look for that constant reinforcement. And I also try to develop options that satisfy a three-part test. One, is it important to the customer? That's obvious. Two, is it unique to our organization, to our particular company? And three, can we defend it in the marketplace? And most negotiators go to, is it important to the customer and unique to us? But no one asks that third question. Is it defensible to us? Can we defend it in the marketplace so we're not taken out by the competitor easily the next go-around? So once I have these options, I'm always negotiating with their interests, and that in lies where we're negotiating value for value. So once we've done that, I then move on to saying, okay, why should they believe me? And they maybe they shouldn't, I mean, because I'm obviously advancing my interests in there. So effective negotiators use criteria to make things as objective as possible. These are precedents and benchmarks and standards. They serve as a filter. As it says on the slide here, and the best example I can give of that is a house purchase. If you're getting ready to buy a house and you want to make an offer, the first thing you're going to do, or I urge people to do, is do a survey of the homes that sold in the neighborhood that you're in or within the school district to get some idea of the similar size house in the similar location, the similar school district, and what they sold for. Because when you go back and you make an offer, you now have objective criteria under which to advance your offer to a potential seller. And many times what was sold is in there, and the prices are a lot less than what somebody may be asking for. And you, in effect, get a valuable piece of information that allows you to validate what the asking price is. More importantly, criteria can be used as leverage, which we'll talk about in a minute. Having that will allow you sometimes to apply gentle pressure to a buyer to show them that where they think they are is not where they really ought to be based on some external data that may be out there. So criteria is something that says, don't believe me, believe this third-party data. Lastly, effective negotiators have a plan if they can't reach their bottom line. And this is the toughest one in the sales world, because everywhere I go, no matter how many places I show up, I always hear I'm in sales, we have no agreement alternative. We have to sell every time. Fair point sometimes. End of the quarter, probably we're at a push to get everything in. But if you think about what your options are as a no agreement alternative, I think you have more than you think. So I'm always asking, what are my no agreement alternatives? Let's take the incident where I was negotiating in the Chicago airport over this rather large deal. I started thinking, what are the other things, potential deals I have on the table? And what if this one doesn't go the way I'd like it to? So I think of that the next deal I have or two or three other deals and say, which one's my best? And I pick my best option, which we would call a BATNA, your best alternative to a negotiated agreement. Maybe people have heard of that before. And I say, okay, I'm pretty confident that this one's coming in, therefore I can be a little more confident in my negotiation. If I didn't have one and I thought the deal was a poor deal coming in on my side, then I'd have to say, gee, I got to stick in here and be a lot more creative to get what I need in this particular negotiation. So it's always important to have that. It gives you confidence in the negotiation. More importantly, can I increase the value of my no agreement alternative? Can I do some more work on it and find how right or wrong I am within my judgment of whether it's a good deal or not? Effective negotiators ask a very critical third question, which is, what is their no agreement alternative and what's the likelihood they will exercise it? I do many times, especially in the world of sales, I'll sit with corporate accounts people and national accounts people, and I'll sit there and say, well, wait a minute, what's their no agreement alternative? And what's the likelihood they'll exercise it? More times than not, I find we're in a better position than we think. And just having that information, it gives you confidence. I happen to be in a shuttle from the Phoenix airport to a place where I was going to do some work. And I was in the shuttle with someone that was going to be attending the particular session that I was in. And so we struck up a conversation, and she said, you know, well, let me tell you a deal I'm doing. And she went through the facts of the deal, and I said, so what are you planning to do? She goes, well, I have it, you know, X numbers of tens of thousands of dollars in front of this particular person, but I think that what they really, they want it for less, they want it for X, which was about $20,000 less. And I said, well, what do you think about it? He said, well, you know, I'm thinking that's probably pretty fair. And I said, okay, well, why? And she walked through a number of things. I said, well, what's their no agreement alternative? What will they do if they, you know, if you don't lower your price? She said, well, nothing really, because the competition isn't a really great product. They've already acknowledged that. So we're really down to just coming up with what's the appropriate price. I said, so are you confident in where you're going in? And she said, well, no, not really. I said, but there's no real alternative here. And you've said they're going to do this, so they're not really going to walk away. And so you can get my drift that we should be much more confident in that. So she ended up lowering the price by about $4,000, but a lot less than what she was going to in the beginning, just by answering that particular question and thinking about it a little bit. So build your confidence, and it keeps a good attitude that we need to grow that business profitably.
You know, Scott, this really is a useful approach. It's really helpful. When I have this and I've got all this information, then how do I apply it?
Sure. I want to give you a thinking approach to negotiation. Once I have all this information, I then take a step back and I ask myself some questions. And the first one I ask is, what are my negotiables? And I think it's one thing we don't ask ourselves in a negotiation. What are all those things, based on the interests and potential options I'm putting together, that I could be negotiating with? Things that are are valuable to the customer, relevant obviously, they're a real value to us, and they induce action. So I try to think of what are those things and make a list. And many times people don't do this. It's akin to when I was a lawyer, the first thing, anytime a case came in front of us in tort law, a negligence case or something like that, the first thing I asked was, are there any damages? Why go through any of this if we don't have any damages to go after at the end? If there were, the second part of the test always was, are there any assets to get? If there are no assets to go after, it doesn't matter how big your damages are. So it's almost a predicate to saying, if I have nothing to negotiate, I'm in a very different position than if I can come up with lots of different things and levers that I can. Some may be relevant to the customer. I may put things in that are not as relevant just to negotiate out along the way. But I need that list of negotiables that hopefully are all around the interests of what the people that are negotiating want. The next thing I then say, who are my negotiators? And this is goes right back to what we talked about earlier. Who are our negotiators? The first thing is, who in my organization do I need to get interested in the negotiation, and do I have them at the table, and can I bring them at the right time? The next thing I say is, who are their negotiators? Obviously, this goes back to the question of who are the interested parties and who are the parties that want to get interested. But more importantly, how do they think, and do I have all the critical interests I need at the end of the day so I can match negotiables to interests? From there, I look at it and say, what leverage do I have in this negotiation? And for salespeople, this is the area that I think we focus on a lot in my work, because they don't believe they have any power in the negotiation. They believe that the other side has the power because they have the power of the pen, but we can create leverage. Leverage comes from a few areas. First and foremost, it comes from interest. If we understand people's interests, right, information, if we understand that, we can use that as leverage to in our negotiations as to what we bring into the negotiation or what we take out of the negotiation as we're negotiating value for value. The more you're taking things away that they're truly interested in, the more pressure you can put on them within the negotiation. Secondly, criteria are leverage. You can use that as leverage to say, don't believe me, believe this. Relationships are leverage. Leverage is perception, but we need to build that and then bring it in at the right time in our negotiations. And the largest leverage piece you have is a no-agreement alternative. If you have a good no-agreement alternative, you have lots of leverage in a negotiation because, in the end of the day, you could walk. And if the other side doesn't have a particularly strong no-agreement alternative, you have an even stronger set of leverage at the end of the day. Lastly, we come down to strategies. Once I have all these other things and I know where I'm going to say, what's my strategy? That falls right into what we call our 4D. You know, how are we going to design, dig and develop, and decide in this particular negotiation meeting? And we take a step back and say, do I want to make the first offer? Do I want them to make the first offer? What's my concession strategy? Again, one of the things I see many salespeople don't have in place is any idea of how their concessions are going to be structured along the way, how many they'll make, and when they'll stop. All these things formulate into a strategy. So, knowing all of this above helps us create the strategy.
You know, Scott, this is really good stuff. Is there, once you have this and you've gone through this thinking approach to negotiation, then any way from that point to optimize what you're doing?
Yeah, a couple of pointers on that and from that perspective and for people to think about. I always think about how do I optimize things, and we're going to get right back to basically attitude more than anything else. The first thing is assuring you that you know your interests. I was working with I got a call from a person because after I do any of my work, I say, look, if you ever get stuck and you want to talk about a negotiation, it's free. Just pick up the phone. We'll talk for 20 minutes and see if I can help you in any way. And so this woman called me up. She said, Scott, I think I'm going to cave. I've got a $2.3 million deal sitting in front of this particular customer, and they want to pay, and they're at the line of saying they won't pay any more than $1.6 million. So we got to we got a $700,000 gap that we're talking about. And she, I said, so why do you think you're going to, you know, cave? And, of course, she got all the regular answers of, well, it's the end of the quarter, I need the numbers, right? And I said, so let's take the $700,000. How much does it represent to you in commission? And we figured that number out, and it was a fairly sizable number. So I said to him, I said, well, what would you do with that money? And she said, well, I'd pay bills. I said, well, yeah, well, we all have to pay our bills. But, I mean, what would let's assume you're going to give it up. What if you found it? What would you do with it? She goes, well, I don't know. She said, one thing is we have some property up in the mountains, and we want to always build a house on that. I said, okay. I said, anything else? And she said, yes. And I have a two-year-old, and we've just started a college fund. And so I said to her, I want you to write those two things down, stick them in your pocket or purse or notebook or whatever, and every time you concede, I want you to remember you're taking those dollars out of your daughter's college fund. And I tell that story for a reason, because knowing our true interests, not that I just have to get the deal or I want the commission, but what am I going to do with it, will make you stand much tougher in a negotiation and optimize your negotiations for the longer run. By the way, she did come back, and she did have to concede, but she ended up coming in at a little over $2 million in that particular deal, so nowhere near where she thought she was. And what we found out was the buyer was grandstanding at the end, just trying to get the lowest price they could possibly get. The next thing we talked about, setting those high expectations. Don't forget to do that. That's how you optimize. It's 25 to 30% additional value if you can do it. Three is managing emotions. We always talk about being unemotionally emotional. There's times to be emotional, but most times you don't want to be emotional. Two things occur. Once you become emotional, buyers or the other negotiating partner know they have you sometimes, and they're going to play on that. Secondly, once you show emotion, many times you lose credibility. And what it can devolve down into is haggling. And so we try to avoid that. So the more you can be objective in your negotiations, the better. Fourth is never overreact. Some people say, well, that's like being emotional. I say, yes, but they're different. I see lots of great salespeople be marginalized in their organization because the buyer comes up to them and says, if you don't give me this price tomorrow, I'm going to go with the competition. And rather than doing any more exploration with that particular buyer, they run over, grab the gas can, douse their hair, set it on fire, and start running around the organization trying to get the price lowered with no objective reasoning. And what they end up doing is destroy their credibility. So I always say, try never to overreact with your customer or with your company, because in order to be effective with your customer, you have to be credible with your company. And in order to be effective with your company, you have to be credible with your customer at the end of the day. The next one is testing assumptions. When you fill out the interests and the options and criteria and other things and talk about their no agreement alternatives, many times they're just assumptions. Yet I don't know how often we take it as a given. I was working with some people in Germany, and they just said to me, no, this is the way they do it. This is the way they want it. We've been doing it this way for 15 years. But we never tested whether there were any other alternatives. And when we went in and tested, we found out we had a few other alternatives rather than the way they wanted to go. But they just made an assumption. The worst assumption we can always make is that if you think it's going to be about price, I can guarantee you're going to go in and negotiate just on price, because you'll drive it there rather than coming up with other ways of approaching it. Lastly, always, 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 always prepare. I can't say anything more than that. So these are some of the success stories of places that we have done business on the negotiation side and built negotiation competencies in many of the companies. In every case, we had specific objectives to go after and achieved it by concentrating on just the basics I talked about today. The same can happen for any sales team, I believe. I always find there's lots of low-hanging fruit to go after, especially in today's type of economy. There's a lot of things that fall off the plate because we're being more efficient than effective. And I can usually find those places, and we can, like I did for one particular company that's a $100 million division of a large company, where we implemented one of these strategies, and at the end of the year, netted another $1.2 million of cash to the bottom line just based on negotiating strategies that we put in place. It produces bottom line results.
Thank you so much. This is tremendous information and has really been helpful for us. So we appreciate you taking the time today to do that. And we'd like to give you, who are on the phone, an opportunity to ask Scott a question. And if you have something, it may be specific to you, but the application is general to others on the phone. If you'll press *6, you'll be able to ask Scott a question. That should work on the phone at this point. So let's turn it over to you on the line. Any questions for Scott? Please press *6.
Hello?
Hi.
Hello? Yes.
Scott?
Yes?
Yeah, hi. Roy Garizio with WD-40. How are you?
Oh, hi, Roy. Good. How are
Good.
You?
I enjoyed it very much. I do have a quick question on the when you were talking about the 9 indicators of a sales force
yep.
and negotiation. One of them had to do with sales managers should be a coach only and not the negotiator.
Yes.
Sometimes it's very difficult when you're with a seeing a very important customer and you are the manager there not to get involved in the negotiation because 9 times out of 10 they turn towards the person who has the senior ranking, so to speak, in the room to see if, in fact, you'll negotiate with them. How do you avoid that?
Yeah, I think that's a very real issue. I think you have to always – it's part of how you strategize doing it. I always want to keep, for obvious reasons, the power in the sales representative's hand
mm-hmm.
Because there's downsides to not. The instant you step in as the manager, you end up owning the account.
Right.
Secondly, what I find is that when you bring the manager in, everybody knows there's a bullseye on the back of this person, right?
Sure.
This is the person who's going to give me the discount. The longer you can keep them out of it, I advocate having them come in early in the deal, being
okay.
a part of all the discussions up front, getting to know everybody up front, and making it very clear that the sales representative is the person that will do the negotiation.
Okay.
And keep the person in the background. Obviously, the sales rep is always talking to the manager, saying, "Okay, what do you think about this? What are our potential options going in?" But this person maintains control within the negotiation. There may be times at the end they do want to see you at the very end. That's
sure.
part of the concession strategy we put together. We say, "Okay, when you go in, here's what I'm going to concede at the very end."
Mm-hmm.
But it'll
okay.
be a team approach. So that's what I do. It is hard to do. I agree.
Yeah.
But if you can keep them out, it really creates a stronger negotiation.
Okay. Thank you.
And
yep.
couldn't that be part of the preparation to define the roles?
Oh, sure. Yeah, absolutely. If you're anytime you're going in and you're setting up the strategy, as I call it, we all say, who's going to do what when, right? When are we going to move the chess pieces around? And these conversations don't have to be cumbersome and long. I've sat in cars going in, and we've kind of lined up what role everybody's going to play in that particular negotiation. Sometimes one of it is the manager's just going to be the information person. Anytime they talk about negotiating anything, manager's going to look at the account manager.
Mm-hmm.
So we always give the power back and the authority back to the account manager to do everything. The more you do that, the more you'll find that the buyer kind of leans that way. But, yes, it should be part of the strategy before you go in.
Great
Any
question.
Other questions?
Thank you. Yeah, press *6 if you'd like to ask another question of Scott. Okay, good. Scott, if you could advance to the next slide, what we'd like to do is for any of you who would like to receive a copy of the slide deck or receive a copy of the negotiation field book or set up a follow-up consultation call with Scott, please contact your Advantage partner, and we'll be happy to set up or provide any of these things for you. Again, thanks to all of you who have been on the call, and Scott, a special thanks to you for
My
sharing
pleasure.
This information with us today.
Yep.
Thank you.
Yep.
Thanks,
Take
everyone.
Care.
Thank you.
Yep. Yep. Bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.